Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
So I saw that movie, Japanese, they called it Fantasy, but here, what's it called? Your Highness, with Danny McBride and Natalie Portman and James Franco.
Yeah. I heard that was terrible.
Yeah.
That was not a no.
Yeah, I laughed a few times. There are a few good jokes in it, but yeah, not really worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Natalie Portman looks hot.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh. I can't say she's unattractive.
Well, you know.
Of course. Yeah, I just.
Well, you could. It just wasn't true.
Well, I guess if I was gay, it would be truthful.
Uh-uh.
Yeah, there you go. Ha!
You've been shown, Wayne.
Yeah, you told me!
No, but I've always been on the fence with her. Is she good or not? But this one, she looked really good. She had like this leather bustier that pumped her boobs up, and there was a strap in between it. So her boob looks nice.
Her boob looks nice? Is she an Amazon show?
Her boobs looked nice. Part of my conjugation.
I've been in Japan too long. No plural.
I like the boob.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I want to see a King of Badass them.
Oh, cool. Was that good?
I want to.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's coming out this
year. I can't speak or comprehend.
No, I want to see that too. Only because it has, what's the actor's name? The guy who plays Jason in the...
Ryan Quanten?
Yeah.
Quanten? Yeah. Yeah, no. He doesn't look like him, though.
No, he doesn't. Yeah.
No. He doesn't look like himself in that. And it's got, what, Peter Dinklage?
Oh, cool.
Tyrion?
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Tyrion Lannister?
I've never been disappointed by him in a movie.
And Steve Zane.
Oh, cool.
And people who listened to the Thrillers episode knows that Steve Zane... did I really go on about Steve Zane in the Thrillers episode?
No.
Yeah, in my mind it was. When I was talking about Joyride. Actually, in the show notes, that's who's quoted.
Ah, I see.
That's his line.
You did go on about Joyride, just not about Steve Zane.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I should have, because he really made that movie.
So if you're listening to Thrillers and Telepathic...
And it was, we had to have a mental track as well.
Yeah. He's in that. And Summer Glau is in that.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And the trailer, she looks really good in that.
Excellent. Good boobs.
I don't know where Chris is at, you know.
Maybe she did ballet in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of tells you something.
Mm-hmm. No, I know. I watched Firefly.
Yeah. And she was like young.
How old was she in Firefly?
I don't know.
Hmm.
She looked young.
I have to look that up because otherwise I'm going to feel guilty all night.
Really? You found her attractive in Firefly?
Yeah.
I thought she looked like the kid that she was.
Don't get me wrong. Like, I didn't like, oh, hot. But like, yeah, she's pretty cute.
Okay.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I did.
Well, it's now part two of Apocalypse. And I know we said we were going to jump right into post-apocalypse or the debate, the Zompocalypse debate.
I believe it was the Zombar.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Sorry about that. That was me.
Why do I keep forgetting that?
Because I want to.
But I think there was something that we didn't talk about during the apocalypse that I want to bring up. I think it's really well done in the movie Pontypool, which I've talked about before, mm-hmm. And it's set in a radio station. So it's a horror movie, but it's a good example of during the apocalypse. And they're kind of trapped, or they choose to stay in the radio station. And then they're getting in reports from outside. A traveling reporter, for example, you know, calling in and giving them reports and describing what's happening. And I think that could be a really good thing to add in during the apocalypse, whether they're in a bomb shelter or they're in, maybe even in the lab if it's a pandemic, but you're constantly giving them different reports of what's happening. As on apocalypse, they're in the house or they're on the military base or whatever, and they're getting it, you're feeding different reports of just how it's escalating. Or if you have the person that's providing them the information is maybe somebody that they care about, a valued NPC, then that can really make it more intense as well.
This might sound a little weird, but for my wife's birthday, we went to go see Sound of Music, the musical. And when it was over, I was kind of thinking about how it might make a good campaign in that the story starts out as kind of small potatoes. It's just the family and, you know, the little love stories and relationship with kids in there. But it takes place within the beginning of World War II as a backdrop. And as the story goes on, like, there's much larger events going on around, but the characters are primarily concerned only with their small troubles. But of course, as things get worse, you know, the world kind of intrudes on all that. So at the end, it's kind of interesting that you have all their personal troubles combined with the world troubles. And I think that would be an interesting way to play what you're suggesting there, Lyle, is that you can have kind of this small group and they have their own interpersonal problems, but, you know, outside there's the apocalypse going on, so eventually it's going to touch them. It just kind of stacks conflict upon conflict.
Yeah. I mean, that's good. I mean, it's slightly different than what I'm suggesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Pontypool, they're aware stuff's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So the focus is the apocalypse, but how long they can remain untouched. And really, they're not untouched because they're getting all that information. We were talking before recording about like a cozy, and you were saying that some people describe like a cozy apocalypse.
Mm. Yeah, cozy and, catastrophe.
Oh, cozy catastrophe.
I've heard cozy apocalypse, sorry. Yeah.
And I wondered if that was connected to a cozy, like a mystery cozy,
mm-hmm.
like the one room Agatha Christie style, you know, where Poirot tells everybody what happens.
Because I read this too. I think the cozy mystery comes from, or not, sorry, the cozy apocalypse comes from, or maybe it is cozy catastrophe, sorry, comes from the idea where the main characters are kind of relatively untouched despite the apocalypse going on around them. Like, I think a good example of that is, Day of the Triffids? Because in that, like, the main characters, they still have it relatively well off, right? They kind of go from area of safety to another area to area of relative safety, despite all the things that are happening.
So the unimportant apocalypse.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, I guess, yeah, you could kind of look at it unimportant.
You know? not to belittle it, but I actually read the same definition. Mm. The first thing I thought of was the game Fallout. You know, basically, the characters come out of a bomb shelter. They've lived through the apocalypse with very little trouble.
Oh, yeah, okay. I guess I can see that. I was thinking, when you suggested the news reports, Lyle, I almost would do those as maybe like scenes, like that the characters weren't in, but that they kind of got to witness, because like it was completely different. But I tried to like foreshadow something that was going to happen in the Changeling campaign with news reports on the TV. So it's completely different for an apocalypse, because the players and the characters will kind of know what's going on. So your suggestion of having, like, an NPC who can bring them the reports, I think is a good one. Or if you're going to do, like, a TV report, you know how in, like, a movie, like an apocalypse movie or a disaster movie, sometimes they just have, like, interspersed news clips from all around the world with the different, you know, reporters reporting on the same thing. I would kind of do something like that, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than playing to the characters, you kind of present it to the players.
Maybe. I'd add a caveat to that you have to make sure that there's still something for the players to do rather than just receive and react to news reports.
Yeah.
And can definitely make a good movie or story because you can see how the people are taking this news, but I think players often want action.
Well, that's what I was saying. Like, it wouldn't even be the characters wouldn't even be in that scene. It would just be like a tiny little scene that's not sort of part of the story directly.
I see.
Almost just like, scene. Yeah, just like, okay. You know how like a movie, just like a tiny little scene and then the players have their scene to them, you know.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how, like, characters aren't always going to be near a TV or a radio, or they aren't going to have someone there to give them these reports, and you as the game master may say, well, this is really important. I want to show that all this stuff is going on around the world. The players aren't in a position where they would or the characters aren't in a position where they would logically hear that. So I'm just going to not worry about it and put this scene into the story where the players are the audience and kind of not deal with their characters for that little bit.
Yeah, the news reports is all right. I think if they're getting information from an NPC or something like that, they have control, so they're interacting with the information.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if it is a news report, it's very passive, and they're just absorbing it. Whereas in this case, like if you watch like Pontypool, they're asking them, like, well, what do you see now?
Yeah.
Well, go somewhere safe. Now what's happening?
I think it's a great suggestion. Yeah.
And people should just watch that movie. Yeah. So that was a great movie.
Hmm.
And it's actually an interesting take, someone said, on a zompocalypse, even though doesn't have any zombies.
Hmm.
So it's a zompocalypse without zombies.
Yeah, which leads us into...
It's a sans-zompocalypse.
Sans-zompocalypse.
Sorry.
Leads us into our... the discussion.
Zombar!
Yeah, that you guys were having.
You want to kick it off?
Yeah. So I forget how it started, but Chris, you and I were kind of debating about whether the zombies were actually important in like a zompocalypse. And like I had said before, I kind of sound like I don't have a leg to stand on that one.
But you're talking about an eclipse phase.
No, the argument was about Apocalypse World, Apocalypse World doesn't define, or at least Wayne didn't want to define what the apocalypse was. And I was saying, like, what is that? How can you possibly do that? If it's a zombocalypse versus, say, a plague apocalypse versus nuclear war, the environment is going to be so different. How could you not know what the apocalypse is?
The road doesn't do it.
And you know, actually, after I thought about it, I figured as long as the game master kind of knows the rules and the setting, that they're putting together for it, then that's fine. It doesn't actually matter what the cause of the apocalypse is, as long as the setting is well-defined for it. Because I could see very easily the example of somebody walking out of a bomb shelter. No idea what happened, but just the world is the way it is now.
Well, why are they walking out of a bomb shelter?
I don't know, their air raid sirens went off, or they got a call from someone.
It kind of narrows down the kind of apocalypse.
Or they got a call from someone who said, get into the bomb shelter now, and they didn't ask questions and just what. But I think that if you define what happened, it's probably going to be much easier on you to figure out what kind of a world your players are going to be playing in. But I can understand the argument that it's not technically that important.
Well, I guess my standpoint is, the interesting part for me is how society is going to rebuild itself, or how characters are going to interact with each other when society has broken down. And essentially, everybody you meet is a survivor, and they haven't survived by being nice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe they've survived by being lucky, like getting out of a bomb shelter, but generally the people that did survive, yeah, they survived because they've killed other people, they've taken their stuff, they're not really human anymore, essentially, or they're definitely not nice people. So I guess for that, again, talking about the Apocalypse World game, it didn't really matter what had happened or what the apocalypse was. Mm-hmm. All that mattered was society was gone, and how are you going to interact with the survivors that are left? And yeah, I don't disagree that if it's a zompocalypse, you're going to have bands of zombies roaming around, or if it's like a plague, then you're going to have to worry about, you know, clean water and food, or if it's like a nuclear blast, then areas are going to be irradiated. But I guess for me, when I'm kind of thinking about that, that's almost in the background. Like, it almost kind of is an afterthought to the survivors.
That's true, but you know, I think one of the big themes, I think the two big things that you have, maybe three big things, let me change that.
Should I have four?
Well, I think the three big things that are important in...
Some of the big things.
I think a few of the big things that are important in the apocalypse story is, as you say, Wayne, like interpersonal with the other characters, other people, other survivors, any dangers that are presented by the apocalypse, be it zombies or irradiated areas. And I think one of the biggest things is resources as well. How and where do you get your resources? And again, that goes back to what is the setting? It's going to be very different if you have an ice age versus a desert world.
Yeah, and I mean, if it's everything is irradiated, that factors into what supplies are available. If you compare a movie like, or a book like The Stand with a book like War Day or a movie like Threads, and the latter two are about like a nuclear holocaust, yeah, that's really, really grim. Because even if you survive, you don't really survive.
Yeah.
And in The Stand, it's like, wow, there was a pandemic, but I guess we're immune. And that's like, oh, you know, just let's, you know, have at all this free stuff.
Yeah.
So in The Stand, they almost had to add that supernatural element of the good versus evil, because there is no conflict after the pandemic passes. And in Zompocalypse, I mean, is the danger still around? I guess the zombies, I mean, they're the continuing danger. And that's why I think, like, during the apocalypse and post-apocalypse, it's kind of really blurred. I mean, really, the zombies would probably just die out and, like, they would rot.
28 days, yeah.
Yeah. But then you would just, like, then what are we, you know?
Because
they don't really destroy the environment. So, and I think if you're talking about Zompocalypse specifically, I think you can compare season one of Walking Dead with season two of Walking Dead. And which do you find more interesting? Season one. it's a rhetorical question. And you can see the limitations of, I just want to see the survivors interact. And you're like, well, it can be pretty boring. Yeah. If you just have the survivors kind of interacting and surviving.
I guess it kind of gets into the main points I was thinking of for this episode. Because the thing that kind of makes, I guess, like an apocalypse story is the big two from here, survival and isolation or population, which gets into what both of you guys were saying. Like, depending on the type of apocalypse, resources can be pretty scarce. And in that case, what do you do to survive? And you said something interesting when we were talking about the Apocalypse World game, Lyle. You know, like, honestly, how interesting is it to have a game about trying to get food? Not very, because yeah, there aren't that many of them.
The Road's a really good book. I mean, I won the Pulitzer Prize. But I wouldn't want to play The Road, where it's just a constant search for food.
Yeah.
And trying to escape the cold. Now, probably books based off the Dark Sun setting aren't going to be as good as The Road. But I'd rather play in the Dark Sun setting, because it's just more overt conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Out of curiosity, would you consider that during the apocalypse rather than post?
I'd say that's post-apocalypse, because it already happened, but they continue to destroy the environment.
Okay.
For people who are not familiar with Dark Sun, magic they draw the power through the earth, I guess. Mm. So they pretty much just destroy the environment. That's why it's a desert. Because people called the Defilers or the Dragon Kings as well, they use the Earth's energy to power their magic and basically just drained it dry.
Mm. Jerks.
Yep. So it's somebody once described Dark Sun as like Mad Max meets Conan. That's a good description.
I see that.
That really sells it for me.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, I want to play in that. But if somebody says, ooh, you know, the road meets the threads, and you're like, wow, that's like super depressing.
Yeah.
Sure. Don't think I want to play that.
Yeah.
People unfamiliar with Threads. Threads was a British movie that is maybe one of the most realistic. It's certainly one of the grimmest portrayals of the after nuclear war. And they show even what would happen to the generation after. And they, not to spoil it for anybody, but it's not good. But people even, they just don't talk. So they lose the ability to communicate. And people become sterile, of course. And, you know, trying to etch out a living, scraping in the dirt. So it's certainly nothing you'd want to play.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly something you'd want everybody to watch if they think that there is actually a nuclear option.
Yeah, I think that kind of gets into maybe not a universal problem, but one of the problems I kind of have about running like a post-apocalyptic game because...
Like, did we settle the Zompocalypse debate?
We both just kind of agreed that I think we see the other
person's
point. We
agreed to disagree.
No, I didn't think it was that vehement, but...
We had an argument before, but we both saw each other's point. Damn it.
If you go kind of too far into the future from the apocalypse, then it just kind of becomes another either like fantasy or whatever kind of tech level game you're playing.
And I think there's some good stories there. Sword of Shannara, which is an okay story. And the Book of Lost Swords by Fred Saberhagen. I think he also wrote Empire of the East, and like somebody finds a tank. And it's like a fantasy world, but somebody finds a tank and they call it the Elephant. And I thought it was really good.
I remember seeing somebody's campaign once in a forum that they were talking about that, it was basically a D&D campaign, but it was a post-apocalyptic setting where they would start running across guns and things like that at some point.
It's pretty cool because the lost civilizations are like New York City an army base or something like that. And you uncover these artifacts, which are like modern weapons.
Gamma World.
Okay.
I don't know, again, not to split hairs, but I don't know if I would really consider that post-apocalypse because, I mean, it is post-apocalypse, right? Because
technically,
an apocalypse has happened and like things have rebuilt.
And post
itself.
Means after, yeah.
All right.
But, well done, hair split.
Yeah. I know that just kind of sounds like a lost civilization kind of story, and the lost civilization happens to be more technologically advanced.
Yeah, I totally hear you. I totally hear you.
So, but I guess it gets back into the problem of if you're doing. Yeah, like Lyle said, I was thinking about this. The road, right? There's very few people. And with most apocalypse scenarios, like, a lot of people die. Like, 99.9% of the population dies. But, kind of, how do you deal with that inside a game?
Mm-hmm.
There was, like, a scene in Stakeland where it's kind of only the main characters. And they went in the back roads, right? And it's, like, a really small clip, but they say... That week, or those 2 weeks, you know, we just kind of stopped talking to each other and, you know, they survived. Like, nothing really happened because that's all they said. It was like a week. But they didn't meet any other people. They were just out in nature. And that, to me, kind of says, like, apocalypse because there's no people. But just watching the road, no one would want to play that. Like, okay, another day of just the PC party. What are you going to do? Look for food? Okay. Yeah, that's pretty boring. So a month goes by. Oh, great. You know.
I look for more food.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I guess it's a question about how to kind of show that in a game.
Hmm. Well, you can always add in things where getting the food is difficult or dangerous. Again, going back to the zombie things, you know, if you can't farm if there's going to be roving zombies all over the place. I suppose you could, but you have to keep a machine gun with you or something.
Or just a fence.
Yeah.
Give me 28 days later. Where it's like just... How undangerous a zompocalypse would be.
Yeah.
Because one thing, they just start rotting away very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
They can't go when it's, like, cold. So, and when they go when it's warm, that means they just rot all the more quickly. Mm. Yeah.
So, apocalypse not as scary as you thought it would be.
I liked
which kind of gets back to the point about it's not the apocalypse that's all that dangerous. It's the other people who survived along with you.
Yeah. Or whatever was the cause of the apocalypse.
Yeah, that too, yeah.
I
the zombies.
I read a review of a book a while ago that I wanted to see, but it's about where the governments create this new weapon that's an information bomb, and it destroys all the information in matter. Kind of pretty heavy physics thing, but basically there's these clouds of informationless matter floating around the Earth, and if you go near these clouds, then they pick up the information around you. So your thoughts can be transformed, that will transform this cloud. And usually, since there was this big apocalypse and war where people dropped these bombs, it's usually bad memories of the war. So like these zombie ghost soldiers will come floating out of the clouds and like that. It was a pretty interesting post-apocalyptic setting. I'm sorry, but I can't remember the title of the book.
Do it just suck out your information?
It doesn't take your information, but it uses the information in your head or a memory of your body to form itself, and usually it's dangerous.
So it's Ghostbusters. Nobody think of a god.
Oh, I see. I suppose, yeah, except it's everywhere.
Okay.
Sorry.
I mean, yeah, you need to have something more than just survival, even though, you know, post-apocalypse is like a survival game. Mm-hmm. If you look at, like, A Cannibal for Leibowitz by Walter Miller, that's kind of, I guess it's like an allegory or just a parallel to what happened after the fall of Rome. Mm-hmm. And there's the Dark Ages, and then the monks became the repositories of knowledge. And it's the same idea as like after the nuclear war, people became very anti-tech and started to destroy technology because that's what destroyed the world. Mm-hmm. And these monks who follow this guy named Leibowitz, I think like an engineer named Leibowitz, they start to try to gather and piece together all of this information to preserve it for future society. And they just like they're just copying out these blueprints and things like that, even though they don't understand them. They just think one day this is going to be important. And that adds an extra element, is you're preserving knowledge. A Book of Eli, is that movie, is kind of along that line.
Yeah, it has it.
Just more action-y, mm-hmm. where they're trying to preserve, I guess, the Bible and to utilize. That's kind of like brought up right in the beginning.
I suppose, yeah.
Premise.
All right. Not that early in the movie.
That's actually the title, The Book of Eli.
Title.
Could have been any book.
Yeah, Eli's book.
We got to predict his diary.
Yeah. So that's really good. You almost forget it's like post-apocalyptic in a way, because it's just telling the story of these monks preserving it, and then it kind of jumps into the future to say what.
Oh, that's one that has like three stages?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. I like that one.
Yeah. So there's that. We talked about in part one, mentioned War Day. In that book, there's a nuclear war, and then parts of the United States are like bombed out. I think it starts like during the apocalypse, and then it jumps to 5 years later. And what they do is then they travel through the United States, just seeing what people did and how they survived. And that could be like a nice travel log game. Somehow they survived, you know, the cozy apocalypse, the cozy catastrophe. And then they go through and see the other survivors. And perhaps, you know, that it can be a very dangerous journey. But then you can kind of change it up. Not every session, but every few sessions, what kind of story you're telling. Because you could have, like, people make these, like, little kingdoms within what was the United States. Mm-hmm. And some are, like, very, very similar to modern society. Some of them have maybe regressed to a more feudalistic society. Mm-hmm. It almost would be, like, one of those, like, 80s or 70s or 80s shows where, you know, they travel from place to place. You know, mm-hmm. Like The Incredible Hulk.
Yeah. Or Kung Fu. The legend continues.
Yeah.
I will wander the earth.
Yeah.
I actually really like that idea because, I don't know, it depends on, I guess, on what kind of apocalypse you're doing. But if you think about, like, Gamma World, like, you just have these, like, crazy mutants that kind of, it's a comedy game, essentially, right? Where it's kind of like 80s apocalypse. But, I don't know, that road trip one.
80s apocalypse. Was that a fun time?
I don't know.
Some of the worst apocalyptic.
Huge hair.
Yeah, exactly.
On fire.
Again, I was thinking of, like, Mad Max, you know, and you know, they have, like, the huge hair and the white football armor. Anyway, with the kind of traveling around and finding other survivors or other little kingdoms. And I think that's more interesting because they're actual people, right? And you can interact with them. And, yeah, maybe some of them are, quote-unquote, friendly. Maybe some of them aren't, but...
Well, that fits well with your kind of standard game. I mean, usually characters travel around a lot. As we said before, murder hobos.
Well, yeah.
They're just post-apocalyptic murder hobos.
Well, here they actually, in War Day, they're both authors. And, well, obviously authors wrote the book. The characters are themselves. Mm-hmm. So they imagine themselves during the situation. So they're like two writers walking through. They're not two murder hobos.
Kind of a bit egotistical to say, and here's how I survived the apocalypse. I know I'm surviving how I wrote it in my book.
But if they didn't survive, they couldn't have written the book. Mind's hurt. Yeah. Yeah, but you could have like something like regress back to the wild west, something that regresses even further to medieval times. You could have one where there are mutant animals and what they do in the society that they create. That could be pretty fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Put some fun into the post-apocalypse.
The apocalypse fun.
Well, I just thought that an incomplete post-apocalypse would be fun. Something similar to the movie Day After Tomorrow, where you don't lose all of the knowledge, but you lose all of like the main manufacturing capabilities that you had before, and you lose a lot of land, and there's not 99% people gone. You maybe lose like 80%, so there's still lots of people around. I just imagine like what would change. You know, now we have this kind of small disposable technology, but without the manufacturing skills, there would be artisans, but you could still kind of keep microchips alive. Things would be built bigger and heavier, made to last. That'd be interesting.
That's kind of the premise of that that new post-human studios apocalypse game, Degenesis.
Oh, yeah.
Where, like, it's kind of a, not an incomplete apocalypse, but sections of the world kind of maintain an industrial level of technology capabilities. Mm-hmm. And, like, it was really interesting to read. But just kind of like we talked about, like, in Time for War, if there's this huge kind of imbalance in technology, and there is, like, I mean, people can still manufacture machine guns in some places, and in other places they have, like, sharpened sticks, you mm-hmm. know, then there's nothing really stopping the advanced society from just steamrolling over the other one. And, like,
I think Horse Clans, that series, kind of touches on that. And I think one of the limitations is numbers.
Hmm.
So if you're technologically superior, but very much numerically inferior, then yeah. And especially if you might have an industrial base, but maybe it's a limited industrial base, or maybe your technology is derived from a stock supply, so it's limited in that respect.
Or you have limited survivability resources. Army marches on its stomach. If you don't have food, then you can't expand your territory beyond a certain point.
Yeah, but I think that would be really fun to play with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the Horse Clans, that's, again, it's one of those, hey, let's make the post-apocalypse a little fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's like, that would be like Conan meets Mad Max. I don't know.
Yeah.
What was that that movie? It was took place in South America with the Aztecs. It was kind of the Mayans.
Apocalyptica? The Mel Gibson movie?
Yes, that was it. I didn't remember the name at all, but that fits so well. That's a good example of how you can do that, how you can have a more technologically advanced society versus a lesser one.
I would really want to play up the disparity of technology. Mm-hmm. And I think in Apocalyptica or Co. or whatever. I don't think it's I think it's like
there's not
contrasting like there's high stone age with
low
bronze age or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's not that sharp.
Okay. So you're thinking more like stone age versus modern?
Something like that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Instead of like bringing them to like a Mayan city to sacrifice, to bring them into maybe a Mayan city where they all have guns and computers.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a realistic Rifts.
Yeah, okay.
Ish.
Yeah, realistic-ish.
There's nothing. You can't make riffs realistic. Just
no, I was just thinking it's like, well, what we're talking about isn't that realistic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I suppose, I mean, it did happen back, you know, 100, 200 years ago, where there was such a separation. I guess if you...
Well, even nowadays, I mean, you go into
Papua New Guinea?
Yeah.
There's a lot of choice in there.
True.
And I think isolated tribes like Papua New Guinea and places in the Amazon, it's not like huge societies there.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, and I say that because I know no Papua New Guinean.
Listening right now. I only know one.
Yeah, I mean, all you gotta do is walk out of the jungle for a bit, and then they're in a big airport.
Mm.
Or airport.
And they're on a runway.
Yeah. There's a really good anthology called Wastelands, and some of the authors, one of the authors is George R. R. Martin.
Mm.
And that book
is... Why is he wasting his time doing that and not finishing Game of Thrones?
I think he wrote it like a couple of decades before Game of Thrones. But it was called Dark, Dark, Were the Tunnels. And it's one of the better short stories in that anthology. And that's a good example of when people are very, very separated.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I believe, people on the moon kind of survive pretty much unscathed in the moon colony from this apocalypse. I don't think they really get into what it is. And then the people who survived on Earth and what happened. But we're talking generations apart, generations, and what happens when they meet. And it's, I don't want to say any more, but it is pretty dramatic. Yeah. Hmm. But there, it's like, we're both people, you know? But we've been separated for so long, it's me. So you think about, like, Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
But instead of, like, these evolved apes, you're meeting the next generation. Oh, it's like, if somebody was so separated, like, let's say in a, like a...
Morlocks and Eli?
Okay, yeah, that's a good example. I was thinking Eclipse Phase, you know, where they're kind of post-human.
Mm-hmm.
And then some humans who were separated for so... and didn't know about all these transitions were to meet them, they'd be horrified
mm-hmm.
with what they meet.
That always bothered me about the new Planet of the Apes movie, or the remake.
Which one? The
first one, the Mark Wahlberg one.
Oh, the Tim Burton one?
Yeah.
Well, what could possibly be disappointing about that?
Yeah. No, I just thought at the end, like, you know, spoiler, but the
people, yeah, you probably shouldn't spoil it.
All right. So there's a scene where, like, is exactly what kind of Lyle described happens. You know, you kind of have the things that, or the chimp that they evolved from, and then these highly evolved chimps, you know, and they look at each other and I'm like, they just kind of treat it like a little baby. And I thought, like, wouldn't that be incredibly weird? Like, if you found this little proto-human that was, like, you know, thousands of years kind of evolved backwards from you, would you be like, oh, it's so cute? It'd be kind of like, no, that's kind of weird. Anyway, apparently I'm the only one who thinks so.
Well, I mean, if you look at evolution, some people will look at, like, gorillas and chimpanzees and feel some sort of kinship.
Not you, La.
I feel kinship with gorillas. Maybe chimpanzees are too close to us, and that's why I really don't like them.
I don't like them because they're horrible creatures.
Exactly. Maybe they have too many human qualities,
mm.
and they don't have the breaks, the societal breaks that we have.
Yeah.
You know? So they're almost like a humanity unrestrained.
I think very unrestrained.
Imagine, like, a post-apocalyptic setting run by, like, a real Planet of the Apes run by chimpanzees. You'd be, and yeah, how about that in Planet of the Apes? The chimpanzees are the good ones? The gorillas are the bad ones? And you're like, no, that's
it's the other way around.
Yes. Yeah. The orangutan. I think the orangutans are all right.
They're good peeps. Yeah. Good monkeys. Good
ugliest.
they're good apes.
Yeah, but some people look at them and just like what they are, they're animals. They're beneath us. Another story that's in this anthology is called The People of Sand and Slag, and that's really good. I mean, you guys really like Eclipse Phase, but that's a really mm-hmm. good story on post-humans and how they adapted to survive and how that changes the way they think and interact. And so even if somebody didn't want to play like a post-apocalyptic game but wanted to play like an Eclipse Phase, that would be a really good story to read, is because if you're freed from all of these concerns, like, how does that shape how you interact with each other?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about another one. It's in the zombie anthology. Before people were cranking out zombie books, there was an anthology called Book of the Dead, and it's all like different, you know, stories of the post-apocalypse, like some like zombies falling in love. The story Eat Me. Yeah, that was pretty good. And one is Less Than Zombie, and it's like teenagers, like for university students or whatever, around that, you know, like less than zero, that age, and kind of where that decadence would go and that debauchery would go in a zombocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
So, where not only does like life has no meaning, but death has no meaning either, because they just expect people to just rise from the dead again. Yeah. So that's really chilling. It's, I hesitate to say realistic, but it's really chilling the way some people would, I don't know, react to that kind of zombocalypse.
Mm.
And I guess it touches on what you were talking about in part one, Wayne, when you were saying the apocalypse is going on around them, but they're untouched.
I think it was
untouched.
That specific story you had told me about before that I was thinking of, you know, if you can still kind of have a somewhat normal life while all this stuff is going on, you're kind of during the apocalypse rather than after it.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's why I latched on to zombies, which may not be the best example, but I remember you telling me about that. I'm thinking, okay, well, these kids are kind of having a normal life. You know, they're not fleeing for their lives constantly from zombies, but there are zombies there. So
it'd be kind of interesting. If you have kind of like a Eclipse Phase, but in a post-apocalyptic setting where...
Well, it's not Eclipse Phase.
Yeah, Eclipse Phase is post-apocalyptic.
Yes, sorry. I meant more in kind of a terrestrial sense. Just like, since you're kind of freed from death, you don't age, you don't die. Maybe if you had like reduced food needs, is there really a necessity to rebuild society?
I guess it kind of gets like, is it really kind of like apocalypse too?
Yeah.
Because like, even though like Eclipse Phase is technically a post-apocalyptic game...
It doesn't seem very post-apocalyptic.
Yeah. Which I think is kind of like I said before, like if you're too far away, maybe too technologically advanced, or if society has recovered too much, then it doesn't really feel post-apocalyptic.
Hmm. You know, people joke about, like, when they watch Star Trek and they've got the replicators yeah. and the holodecks. And it also gets into some of the VR stories that are out there, virtual reality stories. Once those are invented and then people are locked in, that could almost be like the apocalypse right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then society just like crashes because people have, it takes away all our ambition and all our desire to do anything.
It's a good webcomic called Dresden Kodak that deals with that.
Yeah.
And it's, you should check it out. It's absolutely gorgeous art too.
Yeah.
But yeah, the, all humans go into virtual reality and they're taken care of by this machine mother and they just lose all ambitions. They stop reproducing. They stop creating things. Yeah.
And you can even play that even in a fantasy setting. When we talk about elves and they say they have a low, birth rate.
Mm-hmm.
There's really no reason why they would have a low birth rate when you think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, if they're very much like humans, it means they can reproduce anytime. So something's happened to them mentally, not biologically, but mentally, where they've reached a stage in their society or in their civilization where they just kind of shut down and then they just lost the urge to reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
Because they couldn't have advanced to where they were with a low birth rate. So they would have probably had a normal birth rate. And then they reach this thing and then they say, wow.
Something like the Eldar out of Warhammer 40K, maybe just taken back to the fantasy setting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought, aren't most elves and kind of the traditional Tolkien-esque fantasy kind of described as like a fading race, you know? Like, they're not really inventing anything anymore. They're just kind of living off the past glory of their civilization.
I don't know. I think the standard D&D elf is not...
Well, I was thinking more Tolkien and D&D may have changed that. But that kind of reminds me of...
But they're not a... No, they're always described, even in standard D&D, as not a dynamic race.
Mm, yeah.
The humans are described as dynamic.
Right.
The orcs are kind of dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
But so why aren't they dynamic? And for them, they're going through either their apocalyptic phase or their post-apocalyptic phase.
Yeah.
It's like something happened internally, you know, not environmentally, but internally. And they've lost it. But they're not even... Maybe externally, you want to survive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's all the pressures externally, you're always fighting to survive. But if it happens internally, that's what you lose.
That could be so much fun. And then you have all these little elven cults. Some are like apocalypse cults. They want to kill off the elves because it's their time. Maybe we've got these other ones that think the gods have stolen their ambitions, so they have to get it back.
Yeah, they try to recapture the fire.
Yeah. Oh,
and yeah, and the other ones are like, look, let's just hasten this along.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It'd be also really fun if you took Tolkien elves, like you said, Wayne, in that they are so much stronger, faster, better, and longer lived than regular humans, but they just lost all ambition and drive.
I kind of saw them a little bit like vampires a little bit.
In fact, actually,
you know, you get like the old vampires,
point, yeah.
You're like, I don't really care anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I've done and seen it all. What more is left for me to do?
Yeah.
Especially with these little nobody guys who will never meet our the greatness that we have.
You're right. With all the talk of elves, we just created vampires.
Yeah. Or I was actually thinking when you kind of said like the races eventually die out, again, that reminded me of like the Uplift series with David Brin. Because, you know, you kind of reading through that, they do make reference to several races who just kind of hit that point where, you know, they just kind of lost that desire. You hit a certain level of kind of intelligence and longevity in the race and they don't have the need to procreate and they're kind of busy kind of thinking about stuff and eventually the birth rate just drops to zero and they just kind of disappear.
Yeah, when you watch something like True Blood, you know, I guess there's a bit of a disconnect that, or maybe not. I think the last time we said that on this podcast, that's, people took issue with us using disconnect. But with the vampires, they're still kind of doing really mundane things.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, geez, how many years have you doing the same thing night after night?
Mm.
It just get like real boring.
Yeah, it was from Twilight. How many times can Edward go through high school before he just...
Apparently a lot.
Going postal, yeah.
Yeah.
It gets back a little to the Eldar about how they're so disciplined because... Like a race like that, you have to have maybe incredible discipline. You're like, I'm sick of doing this, but if I don't do these things and if I don't kind of make myself care about them...
Well, that's because the... But in 40K, they do address that in that the Eldar are living in a post-apocalyptic phase because they did do that. They went the opposite direction.
Yeah.
They became really
decadent,
and that invited Slaanesh, or they maybe even
created
Slaanesh. Yeah. So now they have to be like really, really disciplined. So it's almost like they've crystallized, but they have to, and they're kind of like a tone. The one thing they have, if you took away the Dark Eldar, took away chaos, there'd be no reason for the Eldar to live. It'd be like, well, that's it. I'm tired.
Well, no, they eke along because they want to continue your existence, but it's not a very...
I think they go along
because they do have to eliminate chaos, and they have the Slaanesh that they always have to work against.
But that's really interesting. I think the whole idea of apocalypse of apathy is it's pretty interesting.
I was thinking maybe like an apocalypse that's kind of inside a race, but that the, you know, the other races around it don't know. Maybe elves are completely sterile, or maybe they have...
Or maybe they want to trigger an apocalypse, a new apocalypse, like an external apocalypse, because dealing with that will give them life, you know?
Yeah.
And you think, again, I guess we're always going back to the elves, but even like humans, I mean, we're starting, if you look at like people talking about Japan, how it's stagnating, and it was kind of reborn in World War II. Even in North America, when they look at the greatest generation, they look at World War II, you know, out of the chaos and the fires of World War II, it forged this amazing generation, and people could, like these cults, think, we need another fire.
Yeah.
And they kind of just trigger something, and they want to be, if you want to play it like super heroic, they want to be heroes again. Or you play it more mundane, it's just, they just want to live again.
And if they were high level members of government, that could be such a great political story.
Yeah. Or like vampires. And that's what really made me think of it, is that this is getting really, really, really boring. This, you know, maybe that's why in True Blood, you know, of course you have like World of the, Vampire of the Requiem, Vampire of the Masquerade, and they have this masquerade and they're hiding. So they're like, I am so tired of hiding, not because I'm tired of living a secret. I'm just tired of this life. You know, maybe it's more dangerous to be out in the open, but it's different. So do that. And that could be, like, if you're playing that kind of game, that could be the motivation behind coming out of the masquerade. And maybe in True Blood, that's why the authority decided that vampires should step out into the light, so to speak, is because it's just different and we're tired.
Or you could see, like, if they hadn't stepped out, that would have been their apocalypse. Like, hey, you know, everybody's kind of hit this point where they don't care anymore.
Yeah.
We're dying off, essentially. Something needs to happen to prevent this.
Or, you know, as vampires, they don't have the kind of mortality that humans have. Just maybe they want to take it back a few years. The Middle Ages, those are great. You could burn down a whole city and then just move to the next city and nobody knew anything about it.
Right. That's what I was trying to do in that vampire, the Detroit game.
Oh, cool.
The Tsimisces wanted to do that. They wanted to, like, reset the clock, and their idea was an apocalypse. So trigger that, they'll survive, and then they'll rule that post-apocalyptic world.
Cool.
Kind of added a new element, maybe unexpectedly, as we were talking about in part one. The decisions are whether or not you can or can't prevent the apocalypse. And now we've added whether or not you want to start or not start the apocalypse.
Yeah.
And you could play that internally. I mean, maybe you could be one faction or the other. So I guess you don't want to start the apocalypse.
Sorry, I was going to say, I guess it kind of adds like a slightly sympathetic, what's the word I'm looking for, cast to the otherwise kind of traditional fantasy world-ending campaign, you know? Like, no, like, I'm not doing this because I'm evil, per se. I'm doing this because the world kind of needs this thing to happen. Otherwise, we're just going to slide off into nothing. So... I mean, it doesn't make him, you're not going to empathize with the guy, but at least you'll understand, other than, why are you doing this? Well, it says in the book, I'm chaotic evil, so.
I'm not trying to destroy humanity, I'm trying to save it.
Yeah,
imagine if Saruman said that to Gandalf. It's not like, I want to be Sauron's first servant, or I want to be the ruler, but it's like, aren't you tired of this world? How many years have you lived? And it's like, now it's time to just reshape it and be something different.
And we can do it better. Stronger, faster than before.
Yeah. It cost $6 million.
$6 million.
$1. That's the other thing we need to do.
Step three, profit.
Oh, yeah.
You know, one you could also do with the post-apocalyptic setting is the continuing apocalypse. If you had, for example, a plague apocalypse where it wiped out 99% of the people, but some agent was at work that wanted to do 100%, but now people are so scattered that the plague isn't working, so whatever it was, maybe aliens or something like that, is going around having to exterminate people
Apocalypse 2.
But that could be something that brings a lot of conflict, very immediate danger. Something is out for the characters.
I think that's probably the most important thing if you're running a post-apocalypse game, is there has to be some kind of external conflict. Otherwise,
or internal. There's some sort of
conflict.
Well,
okay, some conflict that comes from other
I agree. Conflict makes for good stories.
I was going to say, simply than other than just surviving, right? Because, like, reading a book, you have that conflict against nature, right? But that's, as we said, not interesting to play.
Yeah. So I was just thinking of Logan's Run, because I can't remember why they determined that everybody has to die at 30. But I'm going to guess it's some sort of reaction or some sort of way to deal with resource depletion. So rather than dealing with the environmental factors, the external factors, you're dealing with whatever your community has decided or whatever rules it's built up to deal with the apocalypse. And you're like, you know, that's just wrong. And you're almost like causing another mini apocalypse because you're trying to shatter that society, you know, to rebuild it again, or just run away. So Logan's Run.
Premise.
Yeah.
Logan's Run.
It's not called Logan's Hide. It's not
Logan's called... Walk.
It's Mosey.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. We didn't even touch on, as Wayne has just coined,
Agri-pocalypse.
I mean, we haven't even touched on the 90% of the bees that are dying out and how that could trigger an apocalypse.
Bee-pocalypse.
Apocalypse.
Yeah. I'm sure there's some kind of scientific...
Do you hear anything? No, exactly.
Where are the bees?
That's the lack of bees.
You know what I mean for that? The X-Files movie.
Was that in the X-Files movie?
No. But there are a lot of bees in the X-Files movie. So this was a knee-jerk reaction. Get rid of all the bees! Get rid of all the bees! They're alien carriers.
Oh.
Not worth it. Totally not worth it. Not at all. Jeez.
And of course, there was a lot of other apocalypse we could have touched. There's one, Dies the Fire, I think it's called, by Stirling, where the laws of physics just stop working. Or some of them stop working.
Okay, that'd be pretty much instantaneous apocalypse, but...
You get hurled off the earth.
Oh, gravity doesn't work anymore. Whoa!
Yeah.
As a quick recommendation, The 9 Billion Names of God by Arthur C. Clarke.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Really short story, but fantastic.
It's like a theological apocalypse.
Yeah. I remember that one. Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess that covers that. So thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online, www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the webpage through Stitcher. You can download episodes off of DriveThruRPG or through iTunes. Check us out with our forums there. Please post and talk to us because we like hearing from all the listeners. We can also follow us on Twitter or send us an email or anything to get hold of us because we always love hearing from you. And, see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Yeah.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.